Guys, Roland here. You know, on my podcast, I love having fascinating conversations with people who have had spiritually transformative experiences. And one of the more fascinating type of spiritually transformative experience you can have is a near-death experience. And with me is an amazing guest who had a near-death experience, who is going to tell us what that experience taught them and how their life has changed since. It's a fascinating conversation that I am super excited to have. You get to meet the guest right after this. Welcome to Conversations with Roland, where the goal of this show is to learn life secrets through diverse experiences. I am your host, Roland Achenjang. Guys, welcome to another episode of Conversations with Roland. As always, I am super excited to record these conversations, and today's no different. My guest today had multiple near-death experiences that profoundly changed his perceptions of life. He wrote about this in his best-selling book, Quarks of Light, A Near-Death Experience. I could talk all day about how he's an author, a father to a child with special needs, a husband to a wife who is a pharmacist like myself, etc., etc., etc. But I want to bring him on and just get his perspective about how his life has changed. And I'm talking about none other than my very good friend, Rob Gentile. Rob, welcome to Conversations with Roland. How are you?
Thank you, Roland. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Life's so fascinating that I want to highlight. We are recording this conversation after, you know, months and months of your team reaching out, and we finally were able to make our schedules work that we're doing this. But one thing that I've just noticed in the 30 minutes that we've been talking and trying to get, you know, our technology all set up before we record this is just how calm you are about sort of setbacks. You know, when our audio went in and it went out and we couldn't hear each other, and you were just very calm about it. And you said, quote unquote, oh, we'll figure this thing out, right? You weren't super excited. And I noticed that. And after reading your book, I do want to point that out as maybe a potential shift to how you maybe would have handled this before you had near-death experience or before you went through these experiences, and kind of ask if that may have been the case.
No question. I mean, I was, my mother used to call me a perfectionist, and now I'm a recovering perfectionist after my my near-death experience. So I really try to take things in stride now, because one of the things that I've learned, Roland, through my near-death experience and coming back and trying to deal with life in the temporal world, is that while we think we control everything and we can control everything, it's really a misnomer. In fact, I found that there's more in life that we cannot control than we can control. And I learned that the hard way. So I tried to take a more relaxed view of what's going on, even in the face of adversity, and try to calm myself and figure out what's going on in the moment and move forward.
I love that. I mean, we could literally end the podcast conversation here and just go away with that message and reflect on it, either through meditation or whatever way we choose to reflect for the rest of the day, you know, realizing that this experience we have, yes, we can appreciate that there's a lot that's beyond our control. And you said, you know, there are some things that you can, and I would want to ask you here, like, what do you think we can control? What have you learned that we can actually control if there's a bunch that we can't, or if there really is any aspect of it that we can control?
In my view, what I've learned to understand and come to terms with in my life is the only thing we can control is our own actions. And I believe that God controls the outcome. But that's really the only thing we can control. And I went through this and I learned this the hard way after I had my heart transplant. And I was living in Chicago by myself after transplant. I had to live there a year in an apartment away from my family here in North Carolina, because you have to live near the hospital for 1 year. They're responsible for you just in case you have a rejection or infection. And I had learned and had a reflection and looked back and actually had a life review during my near-death experience and saw my life and in a regression of events. And I came to realize that all of these things that I had been trying to control and control the outcome, and it was really all folly at the end of the day, because after what happened to me was such a fluke. And that experience transformed my life. And I realized that while we need to do our best and we're responsible for doing our best every day and trying to take care of ourselves, make the right decisions, make the right moral decisions, take care of our bodies, all of these things that we do every day, while all of those things matter and we should do them and make an effort to do them every day, in the end, we only have a limited amount of control over those things, because we live in these fragile clay vessels that we call bodies, but we're really spiritual beings having this experience. So things begin in spirit first, and the outcome we'll talk about a little bit later, because I know that you're going to ask me some of that.
Yes, we will. And I'm excited for it. You know, just to set up a better premise here for you who is listening to this conversation that I am having with Rob. Rob's book, Quarks of Light, is amazing. I think one of the persons who reviewed the book said, this should be a movie. I second that. And I really hope that it becomes a movie. When you say you went through like a hard lesson or a series of hard lessons to eventually come to this belief that you currently hold, that we don't have as much control over life, it's not a joke. It's not a joke. Like your book is just, it's very well written. It brings you as the reader in there with them. And I loved it. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that I am also on a spiritual path. And, you know, a lot of what you were saying resonated with me. And I appreciate one of the really cool things about being human is that you can sort of learn by, you know, experience or by proxy, right? And so you were brave enough to sign up for this sort of life experience and go through it, and I didn't. And so I want to thank you for showing us this one unique way of experiencing life and going through an awakening. And I think that that it's truly humbling for me to share this this platform with you. So
thank you
for that. Yeah. And yeah, with this conversation, then we want to sort of, you know, pick up on areas that you touched in your book that I found fascinating, that I think we could clarify or you could speak to some more.
Sure.
And we'll just start. When you were speaking earlier, you said, you know, we are this spiritual beings having a human experience in this clay vessels, as you call it. So how would you describe primarily the difference between spirit and soul?
Great question. So I believe that our soul is part of and comes from the Creator. That's our soul. Our spirit, I believe, is separation, temporary separation from the soul when we come into human form in our body, because spirit is where our personality develops. And most importantly, spirit is where we come to learn our lessons, and most important, come to figure out what our purpose is. Because I'm convinced, after my experience, that we're all given a specific purpose. And when you think about how incredible that is, that we're each given a talent and a purpose that we need to figure out and we need to fulfill. And, you know, I used to get really frustrated with this and say, well, what's the mystery? You know, why does it why doesn't the creator just tell me what my purpose is so I can just show up, you know, complete it and then go on. But, you know, the point of it is that we, number one, and most importantly, need to learn how to love while we're here, because the creator is just pure love. And the other thing is that to learn how we move through life and learn our lessons, it's always an evolving process. And that is the journey, you know, that's the fun part, that's the journey. And even though we're faced with these vicissitudes in life, I've had plenty, and challenges and adversity, these things can also be gifts, because they're kind of like these spiritual promptings that get us back onto the path. And all of these things are designed for us to remember who we are. And that's the whole point of it. That's the whole point of this journey, to figure out who we are and remember from where we come and what our purpose is. Because I believe that all knowledge, all talent, music, all of these things, we don't create them. They're downloaded from the creator. That's where these things come from. And we're here to figure out what that is and to become everything that we're created to be. Because the bottom line is this, the most important thing that I want to say about this is that I have found out that God both expresses and experiences life through us. That's the only way it could have been designed. So when you really think about that, that here you are, you're your own vessel. You've been sent here with free will to figure out what it is that you're supposed to do, your purpose, your talent that you need to express. It's kind of like this mirror. It's almost like the creator smiles upon us when we figure this whole thing out and what it is that we're supposed to express, because that's how God experiences life, you know? So that's what, that's a long answer to your question, Roland, but that's how I feel about it.
I love it. It's long and it's filled with so much insight, and we can maybe even go down a rabbit hole with some of them, just picking up on the words that you said. And the first one is the word remember. You use the word remember. Yes. And that resonates with me tremendously. And so I want to ask you, why is it a remembering and not a discovery? Why is it not something we're figuring out new, essentially? Or why did you settle on the word remember there?
Well, I think it's both. I think it is remembering and discovering. It's a little bit of both, because we're remembering from where we've come, because we all come from that one source, by this loving creator. And it's discovery at the same time. I mean, we're sent here to discover. And, you know, we can really, like you said, we could really run down this rabbit hole, because I also think that, and I believe this about my daughter, Maria, I believe that as spiritual beings, we have chosen certain paths, predetermined sometimes certain paths, in order to, one, learn things for ourselves so we can evolve even further in spirit, and two, to teach others. Through my daughter, Maria, I've been able to, well, I dedicated the book to Maria because she's the one that convinced me that God exists. And while we might find that counterintuitive, that a severely handicapped nonverbal child is the one that convinced you that God exists, it's kind of, you know, crazy when you think about it. But that is the power of the spiritual realm. And when we really understand that that's our true being, and that these clay vessels we're in are just temporary vehicles for us to run around down here and learn our lessons before we go back.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, a lot of what you're saying is cataloged in my book, Who and Why You Are, All You Need to Remember. Very similar things. And I liken this clay vessels to avatars that you pick to play a certain character and experience life through the lens of that character, which many times it's kind of limited and defined for a purpose, right? So you limit yourself, and that allows you to define yourself And essentially, it's to fulfill a purpose. And one of the ways you describe the purpose is to learn lessons or remember or discover, like you just spoke about. And so with these purposes that you're working towards, you know, figuring out, who sets them for you? Is this a choice between you and the creator of all things? Or does the creator say, hey, today, this soul, I'm going to send you to planet Earth, and this is what you have to accomplish? How do you think that works?
Boy, Roland, if I can answer that, I mean, that's part of the great mystery, you know, which comes first. But I think that if we were to, instead of trying to intellectualize that, if we could accept the fact that we are part of this irreproachable light, part of this, and this is, it lends itself to the title of my book, Quarks of Light, where we're each a tiny spark or quark of light that comes from this creator, which I believe is irreproachable light and love. And I think it's just a piece of that light that, you know, if you could, almost like a sparkler on the 4th of July, you know, a piece of that spark goes out into the world, and what it becomes is determined by our actions. So it's a very difficult thing to define intellectually as to, oh, does the creator one day say, hey, I want you to go and learn this lesson? I don't have an answer to that, but I do know that we are definitely destined to determine that and figure that out for ourselves. Because I've come to understand, when I saw this incredible web that I became part of, that this web of lights, that it was an interactive web that just binds us all, and how we were all connected and how we were all one, there were dark parts of the web, and there were very light and bright parts of the web. And I understand now that those dark parts of the web were human beings, because each spark of light, each quark of light in that web represented a life. And those darker parts of the web were places where we weren't really fulfilling our purpose, and we weren't becoming everything that we were created to be. And that really scared me when I was in that place, seeing that and understanding that, gosh, if I don't fulfill my purpose and really get after it in the spiritual realm, what does that mean? Does it mean a distance from the creator? You know, could that really be maybe what hell represents, you know, in some of the religious texts? Maybe hell isn't some place where it's a lake of fire that we burn forever. Maybe it's just a distance from God's love and light until we learn those lessons.
And were you able to get sort of a clarification about this during your NDE experiences, about whether or not that darkness or the dark spots or the spots that were void of light could be?
Yes. I definitely think that those were human beings that were not emanating light, because in the temporal world, either through the vicissitudes of life, adversity, circumstances out of their control, bad personal choices, addictions, whatever those things are that drag us into the darkness and prevent us from becoming everything that we were created to be. That's what I came to understand that those dark parts of the web represent. And we can get into that a little bit further, but this is why I came back with this enormous wake-up call, like, wow, that's what that was. And that's how important it is for us to take responsibility for our own lives, our own actions, figure this thing out, express our talents, love, and spread as much light as we can. Because in the temporal world, which I believe, and the spiritual world are just, they mirror each other, is how I believe it works. Through my experience, that's what I understand.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I really love that you went through this experience and you're able to share, you know, your perspective from this. And that's one thing I like to do in conversations with Roland is celebrate the unique ways in which we're all perceiving life, influenced by our experiences. When you're speaking about, you know, these quirks of light, Rob, how would you describe the dark spots as nodes where you would otherwise see light, or are the dark spots the background through which you're able to see the light? Like, you know what I mean? Is it the background? Is there like a dark background and then you're seeing dots of lights on it? Like you would look at the night sky and you would see the stars kind of dotted on this background of blackness or darkness? Or are you saying within the connected quarks of light, where you would otherwise see a bright light, there was still a dark spot there? How would you describe it?
Okay. Yes, the latter. Right.
Okay. So that's a huge clarification for me, partly because my book actually takes advantage of like a quarks of light. You probably can't see it very well, but they are like this geometric shapes in the background of my book.
I see that. Yes.
Yep. And that was part of my awakening, or one of my awakening experiences, where I saw that the stars in the sky were actually communicating with each other through this connected highway. And then it made sense to me that we're all doing the exact same thing. We're all this connected highway with nodes. And so when you know, in reading your book, I was like, I wonder if he kind of saw it the same way I did with my own experience. And so that's what I was asking.
Exactly. No, that gives me chills when you... Because it's the same concept. We just saw it differently.
Ah, beautiful. Okay, now, catch 22 here, right? When you see that spot where you would otherwise see a bright light is kind of dimmed, that's an individual who has not. I don't know the best way to describe this, but an individual who is maybe not walking his path or fulfilling his purpose per se, and so. How does that work? And I'm asking this to reference in your book, you talk about your brother-in-law, Frosty, right? Mm-hmm. Where he had passed and you're in the hospital and he comes to you, right? Frosty, who had already passed, comes to you and he kind of tells you that, you know, he's made a mess. He now needs you to do the cleanup. I shouldn't laugh. Sorry, I should have laughed.
That's okay. No, it's okay. I laugh about it now too, so it's all right.
Okay, appreciate that. But you know, so how does that work with individuals who need to kind of walk their path, and then when they come to you to say, "Hey, I need you to clean up the path that I walked," essentially, how have you understood that to work?
Well, keep in mind that was and to give your listeners a little bit more of a background about that. So my brother-in-law, Frosty, had unfortunately committed suicide 7 weeks before that night that I died. And Frosty had suffered from an anxiety disorder. He was, you know, going through a divorce. He was living with his parents. There was a lot of pressure on him. It was near the holidays, near Christmas, trying to figure out how to pay bills and so on and so forth. And he had gotten addicted to drugs, but had been clean for about 5 years, even though he was on other medications to keep him off the drugs. But all this came to a head, and he went out that night to blow off some steam and got a hold of a street drug that was something that he didn't expect. And it drove him mad for like 30 minutes. Had Frosty not done that, taken that drug, I know he would never have taken his own life. So I believe what happened with Frosty there is that his spirit was unsettled. He took this drug, he went mad, he took his own life. And when he came to me, it was kind of like when he said, "I made a big mess out of things. I need you to go back and help clean things up, but tell my family I'm in a good place." And he had a lot of regrets. It was metaphorically go back and help clean things up. In other words, you know, kind of, I think this, his whole purpose was to give his parents and his daughter some peace about what had happened, that he was in a good place. And to go back and clean things up in the sense that, hey, tell them the story. Tell them that I know I made a mistake. I wasn't in my right mind. And give them some peace through this experience that we've had together. And let them know that, you know, I'm still in the love and light of God's presence. So I think, Roland, that was more of him not saying, hey, go back and physically clean something up or do something for me that, you know, I messed up. It was more of that. And I don't find these things hard to understand, particularly, you know, you look through all religious texts, regardless if it's the Bible or the Quran or whatever belief system in the world, you know, spirit have always appeared and come to, particularly in the Bible, and come to different prophets and people like that, and given them, you know, direct orders, right? Go to this place and do this. And why would we find that hard to believe when we're spiritual beings having a human experience? You know?
I love that. And when you talk about at the beginning that we are the creator, you know, creating and experiencing itself through its creations, when I read this, right, another aspect about this that came to my mind was, well, this is just another way to experience itself, like the creator to do this.
Yes.
In the sense that, okay, I am a soul or a spirit that had this traumatic event that happened to me. And like, how can I experience myself if I tell another unique aspect of myself to help clean this up? Hmm. And what's neat is when I saw that, I thought, okay, you're going to go back. You're going to do some work with your family. You're going to tell them, oh, I saw Frosty. He's doing well. He needs you to know that he's safe. And to me, that was the cleaning up, which, like you mentioned, was a metaphor for let them know that I'm fine, et cetera. And I'm with the light. I'm safe. You know, this is Frosty speaking. Exactly. And then if you believe in reincarnation and all that stuff, there's the opportunity to go back and rework some of the quote unquote lessons that maybe did not Frosty, you know, while he was incarnate, did not work through in the way he thought would be the ultimate expression of unconditional love for him, in a sense.
Mm, yes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting you bring that up just for a moment. I want to talk to you about reincarnation, because that was not something that I learned through my journey or my experience. So I'm very much still out on that whole thing.
Okay.
Because it just wasn't part of my experience. That's all. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's, again, and I love that too, right? It's a unique way of going through an NDE that wasn't part of your experience. And you had multiple. You had multiple NDEs. So one thing that was part of your experience that we can touch on is the body's ability to heal itself. Can you speak a little bit to what this experience taught you about this supposedly miraculous phenomenon?
Well, this is where it can get sticky, because I believe that this magnificent machine that we call a body that only a creator could have designed, when we think about just the basic functions of the body and how it takes care of itself and removes waste and you cut your finger and it heals itself. I mean, it's just incredible, but it has its limitations. And I learned that the hard way through my daughter, Maria, because, you know, while one can say, well, God created everything, so, you know, why does God create sickness? God does not create sickness. Man creates sickness. All the things that God has created are good, but it's how we use them. You know, you can use electricity to light a house, or you can use it to electrocute someone, right? Mm-hmm. So it's how we use these things that, of course, the creator created everything. So the body, it has its limitations to heal. When it's attacked by toxins that are made in a lab, for example, pesticides, all of these things, that the way we've poisoned the earth and our water and things like that. My daughter Maria was born completely normal. And there was a series of events at 18 months, which threw her body into chaos, and it hasn't been able to recover. And it actually changed and turned off one of her master genes in the brain. So there are limitations to it. And that's why, and I learned that also, Roland, the hard way when, you know, I went through this period where I took Maria to every kind of healer on the planet, you know, and nothing worked. And because I understand now those limitations, and I understand that there are some things in life that cannot be undone. And that's a hard thing to face.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean we and we don't, in Maria's case, it doesn't mean we ever give up trying to find a cure, trying to make her life better, you know, trying to research new things that are coming out all the time. But there comes a time when we have to realize that, you know, there are, like, for example, one of my brothers just had a stroke in the brain, and he's paralyzed on one side, and there's no getting that back. There's been such damage to the brain. So maybe someday we'll figure that out. But in this moment, it's in time, it's not going to happen, right?
Yes. And I want to ask you this, regards to some of the things you said about, particularly with disease, where you say man-created disease. And this is something that I guess I know where I stand when I think of myself as a unique expression of the all based off of my awakening experience. And then I see that if I am the creator's creation, experiencing itself through what I create, many times we might say that and then stop when we come across something that we might say, oh, that's not of the creator. So like if we get cut, for instance, or like you use the example of electricity to electrocute somebody or to, you know, power a house, like where do you draw the line that the creator didn't do this? It's me, man. And the reason, and this is really tough, the reason I'm asking is because once you say man did this, you're not separating man from the creator. You're saying man is not the creator and man is like doing this stuff that the creator wouldn't do. I don't know if you get what I'm saying.
I do. And I think the answer is real simple. It boils down to two words: free will.
Free will. Okay.
The creator made us with free will. If not, could have just made a bunch of robots to run around and do the same thing. So free will is always the answer to that question in my mind, because you have this beautiful machine. You know, we're born into the world. It's pure. It's incredible. The body knows how to heal itself. It knows what to do. If you smoke two packs of cigarettes a day and drink a fifth of whiskey, you're going to hurt it. So it's not the creator doing that. It's you doing it, right?
Mm-hmm. And how does that benefit, if at all? And this kind of comes to, you know, one of the questions I had about the purpose of man. How does that benefit, if at all, the creator? If I instill this free will into an individual and say, go out and, well, you can smoke two packs of cigarettes and drink a fifth of whiskey every day. What does you doing that to your physical body do for me as the creator? How am I benefiting from that?
It saddens you.
Okay.
But it's the only way, like I say, without creating a society of robots. And what could you possibly learn by doing that if everybody was the same or there was some utopia that we all lived in? You know, it would be... might as well not even create. So the only way to do it is with choice. And it all boils down to that choice, that freedom of choice that we were given and born with, that we all have.
Yeah.
That's how I see it. To me, I like to simplify it because it's we can deal with it that way. Because if we start to think about, well, why did the creator allow this to happen? Or then that's I think an eternal question that we're never going to be able to answer, particularly on this podcast, right?
Particularly, well, the creator is eternal and infinite, right? And so I appreciate that perspective. I really do. And we can talk about another topic you mentioned in the book. You're describing the ego and you're describing confidence. In the book, you talk about both of them. And I really liked how you discuss it and would hope that if you can, just tell me what you think the difference between both are. If I show up confidently as Roland, how is that different from showing up egoistically as Roland?
Big difference and great question. So I think that confidence comes from the understanding that the creator, that God, is our real identity. Once we really grasp, and trust me, I had to die to figure this out, okay? it took me 56 years to figure this out. But once we understand that our real identity comes from God, and we build on that foundation, we really don't need ego. Ego is something that comes from the mind. Ego edges God out. Ego tells us that we could do anything that we want on our own. We don't need anybody, you know? And I used to think that way too, until all of a sudden I had a massive heart attack at age 56 and died and went into a 4-day coma. All of a sudden you need everybody to help you. So again, that confidence that comes from the fact that we were born from this creator, we have this power inside of us. It's a light that we have forgotten about. We're part of that light. And once we understand that we were born from that light that created the universe, it's unfathomable to even wrap our heads around. So that's where real confidence comes from. And with that comes humility that, okay, this is where I come from. This is who I am. I really am. So I don't have to be egotistical. The egotists of the world, I think in their heart are sad, lonely, insecure people and haven't figured it out yet that they really don't have to put someone else down or position themselves as being better than someone else to make themselves feel good or more secure. That leads, you know, to a lot of unhappiness and sadness. So that's how I see the fundamental difference.
Yeah. And I like the way you describe both. The use of the word humility that comes with, you know, this awakening realizations is huge. Me in particular, it's just been kind of this awe. Every time I see or interact with anything and I can just take a moment to be mindful about it and appreciate that. Wow, this thing is the creator being expressed. And with that, I'm able to now just go as far back as I possibly can remember to when this thing wasn't what it currently is and how many aspects of the creator had to be part of it in order for it to show up as it is right now. And I'm talking about, I mean, your story is such a great example. All the hardships, all the travel, all the people you met, all the surgeries that you went through, you know, lab test, all of that for you to show up here today as this person. I mean, like I said, if we could make your story into a movie, I'm all for it. Let's do it.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate it.
So, okay, this is a really good transition where from the perspective of Rob Gentile, you've described the difference between your understanding of what ego is and what confidence is and how both can show up. Now, when you were going through your life review, how did sort of judging come up? How were you able to, you know, interacting with this light, review your life? And what was that feeling and experience like?
I tell you, Roland, that's a great question because, you know, judgment is something, even though we don't want to admit it, it's hard for us to admit. We all do it. And as hard as we try to move past judgment, it's still stuck in there somewhere, you know, and we're definitely called to try to remove it. Because when I had my life review, I didn't just have my life review. I had a life review of some of the nurses that were caring for me. And what was interesting about that life review is that I only made judgments and negative assumptions about certain nurses. You know, for whatever reason, we have this in our mind. Maybe that person was overweight or had tattoos I didn't like, or whatever those things were that I was making these negative assumptions about. And when I had their life review and I had my own life review, it was in a regression of events. It went backwards in time. And each time there was like a watershed event where that person maybe was abused or circumstances out of their control happened in their life, how they were raised. All of these things were part of this, you know, movie that was going backwards at high speed. And when something like that happened, where that person's spirit was being affected in a negative way, it would stop just for a second so I could catch a glimpse of what happened to them that made them who they are today. It was like this portrait was being painted of who that person had become and why. And that happened to me as well. And I remember in that place thinking, oh my goodness, how could I possibly judge these people so harshly? And how could I have judged myself so harshly for my own mistakes? Because, you know, we're all evolving all the time. And we act sometimes out of what we know at the moment. You know, if I knew some of the things that I know now, back then when I was making those mistakes, I never would have done them. But we can only act on the information that we have at the time. And while we are responsible for our actions, and I don't anyway want to say, hey, you know, all these bad things happened to me, so it's okay that I go out and continue to do bad things to people or make poor choices. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that judging other people also affects our spirit negatively because we're all connected. But it doesn't necessarily mean we have to, like I say, let them off the hook. We're all called to take responsibility for our actions and become the best that we can become and work towards that every day. So it's a tricky thing. You know, I love this story about Mother Teresa. I read an interview one time when Mother Teresa was alive. A lot of people don't know that Mother Teresa of Calcutta, you know, she struggled with her faith her entire life. And she, in Calcutta, she was there because she wanted to face her own demons and figure out why she was, you know, judging, figure out why she still struggled with her faith. So she put herself, you know, right in the middle of it to try to learn these lessons. And it really wasn't, obviously she was a Christian, and it really wasn't until the end of her life that she said, until I learned to look at another human being and see the Christ in them, I couldn't stop judging. So it took her almost a lifetime to get to that point where she can look at someone for what they were and what they had become standing before her. But when she saw the Christ instead of that person with all of their mistakes, she was able to accept them and not judge them. So this is a really difficult thing, and I'm glad you brought it up so we can talk about it, because it's not something easy to overcome in our lives, and we have to work on it. And even for I still make mistakes today. You know, I'll continue to make them because that's just part of who we are. But I can tell you that judging negatively affects our spirit, both here in the temporal world and in that spiritual realm. So we have to be careful of it.
We do. And I love your answer. It was, you know, very eloquently put, really nice. And with my own awakening and my current perspective, you cannot be human without judging. And I exactly. think the quote I came up with was, we become human to learn to judge, to eventually learn not to judge. So you can only learn not to judge by judging. And a classic example would be, you know, your team deciding that you should come on conversations with Roland. That was a judgment call, right? And many times we can see that because we are making judgments all the time, we are defining ourselves. I am Roland. Yes. This is what I mean. And this is who I am. It's all a judgment, judgment, judgment. But if you are paying attention to what these judgments are doing to you, primarily you see that they are limiting you. And that's perfectly fine. In order for you to eventually embody this sort of spiritual, all-encompassing, infinite self, you have to continually judge and eliminate those barriers, judge, eliminate, judge, and so that keeps on going. But the beautiful thing is eventually when you can see past all the judgments, right, that you've ever made about anybody, which is, like you said, you're really making it about yourself, because it will affect you as well, especially on the other side when you are, quote unquote, going through your life review. Once you've gone through all those judgments and you've passed just about every judgment you can, and you've seen how it has limited you and you've overcome that limitation, yes, then you see the Christ, you see the Spirit. So I couldn't agree more. That was really beautiful the way you put it.
No, and, thank you. You tied it up very nicely for me. Thanks.
You're welcome. And now the other thing, you know, you spoke about is when you were in that space and you were able to go through a life review of yourself and of the nurses that, you know, you were passing judgment on, which is okay by my book today, right? You said they went through certain experiences, and when those experiences were particularly negative, it helped define them, and you saw how that affected who they became.
Right.
And many times we hear that we're born innately good, and then the experiences we have turn us into these beings that were not necessarily always good. And I have a daughter. She's 6.5 months old. And you can relate to this as someone who has a daughter, regardless of how they are experiencing life on planet Earth. What if it's a son? Just the love that you have for these, you know, little tiny creatures that are dependent on you is insane.
Yeah.
And she's been very, very beneficial to my spiritual growth as well, just watching her and interacting with her. And one of the things that she has made me realize, this whole idea of that we are born innately good. Is that really the case, or are we born with the opportunity or with the knowledge to choose good and also choose the, you know, the opposite of good? And then kind of life gives us those opportunities with the experiences that we have and the relationships that we build. And what has your awakening taught you about this? Are we just born perfect and then life kind of puts us down a different path? Or, like I said, are we born with enough knowledge to be perfect and enough knowledge to be not perfect, and then we're giving opportunities to sort of express either one of them?
You know, Roland, I agree with what you said initially. I believe that we're born innately good.
Okay.
And that it's our circumstances, how we were raised. We were born with this moral compass. And innately we know. And even, you know, when I have childhood memories when I was growing up, and whether it was something as simple as disobeying my parents or, you know, whatever it is that I was doing as a child, I innately knew that I wasn't supposed to be doing that. So I believe that the Creator puts this moral compass in us. We're born innately good. And then, again, it comes back to choice and free will. You know, we can choose to do good or bad. And these things, you know, accumulate as part of that life review. These things continue to accumulate through our life. But yes, I believe we're born innately good.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's neat. I love that perspective. It's something I'm still working on. I'm looking at my daughter as, you know, sort of my number one case study for a child, right, that I could observe.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's been interesting to see that sometimes the awareness that she has, like you said, that moral compass, the awareness that she has that if I scream here, I'm going to get, you know, this sort of reaction, or I'm going to get this sort of attention.
Right.
I find that fascinating, because even before she started going to daycare, where I could say, okay, she learned this by watching some other person, this was an experience that she kind of did just with us, with my wife and me. And I'm thinking, how did you know that this would elicit this kind of emotion, right? And if that's something you were born with, oh, what has changed around? Like, what kind of environment have I created that has given you the opportunity to express this, you know, kind of knowledge? I find that, I mean, I don't have the answers either. It's still something I'm observing. But let me switch gears a little bit here. Still focusing on our daughters. You know, your daughters, like the way you describe her in the book is fascinating, right? And when you saw her on the other side, she's this beautiful, perfect being. And what she has given you here on earth as a parent is an opportunity to experience this joy and this sense of pride about your daughter and what they can accomplish in a different way. And I want you to focus on that. It's not necessarily a better way or a worse way. It's just a different way. And can you speak to how that has helped you appreciate the myriad ways in which, you know, parents can enjoy life or go through life?
Sure. I mean, you know, we tend to think of people with disabilities as someone who has no value. And, you know, ironically, so my daughter Maria, she has Rett syndrome, very rare. It's a severe neurological disease. It comes with seizure disorder. It looks like cerebral palsy. She's nonverbal, can't walk, talk, feed herself, the whole nine yards. But spiritually, she's very evolved. And spiritually, it was me working with Maria that God spoke through Maria into my spirit and proved to me that God existed. So can you imagine, here's this nonverbal child who the world might see as having no value, and why didn't you just institutionalize her, when she's the one that convinced me that God exists and the love that comes through her. So that's why I dedicated the book to Maria, because she's really the hero of the story, not me. And it was Maria that showed me how much value someone can have in a different way. So yes, there have been times when it's been maddening for me and my wife, because Maria doesn't speak. We try to, you know, we talk to ourselves and parrot our own talking. We actually speak for her. And that could be really frustrating, because you just, you know, you give and give and give and give, and you're not getting anything back, right? And you think sometimes, why am I doing this? And yet, to see her have evolved into this beautiful human being, that everybody that has come into Maria's life, that has worked with her, caregivers, different people that have come in and worked with Maria through the years, who actually found their purpose through her and said, you know, I want to be a caregiver that works with special needs kids. That's what I'm going to go to college for. Or, you know, now I see what it's like to care for a child like Maria, and I have more empathy for people. So Maria was brought into the world, children like Maria, to both teach us how to love, show us these lessons. Maria and I have an incredible spiritual relationship where we actually, I know what she's thinking. She knows when I'm coming home. It's kind of eerie. The caregivers tell me, you know, when she hears my car, she starts to scream and yell in her own way and gets excited. So she has a knowledge that we can't really understand in so many ways. I think she's so much smarter than me. So there's an appreciation that you develop for children like Maria. So it's been a wonderful journey. Don't get me wrong, it's a heavy price to pay in the temporal world, because there's the care involved for Maria is just incredible, and there's a lot of sacrifice of time between my wife and I and the things that we like to enjoy and do. We don't get to do those things much, but the reward is just incredible.
I can't argue with that at all. And again, the way you talk about her in your book and the way you weave, you know, her influence and the lessons you learned, you know, through Maria, I think it's really, really beautiful. Even the way you're speaking about her right now, I can tell that there is, right, this immense love, this immense appreciation for her bravery. And then from my perspective, your bravery and your wife's as well, right? Because if you think of the creator saying, okay, there's this new way I want to experience myself, right? A family with a special needs child. How, who is going to play this role for me? And then you guys are all like, we got this, you know? I find it's very brave.
I like the way, I really like your perspective on that, that, you know, the creator is saying, okay, this is how we're going to experience this. And that's a beautiful way to put it, because that's how I have felt so many times, you know, throughout my journey with Maria. For example, it's kind of interesting. It took me 3 years to write my book because I work full time and we are up a couple of times a night changing Maria's diapers, doing whatever we have to do. And she has a seizure disorder, so we have to deal with that. So there were times when, before COVID, I was traveling a lot. I was always on the road, and I was trying to, you know, write my book. And the only time that I had to write my book was from 4:30 in the morning to 7:30 in the morning. And it was interesting, Roland, because there was something about being in Maria's presence that made me a better writer. When I was on the road and in a hotel, I would think, man, this is my time. I've got my free time now and I can really get into writing my book and, you know, nobody's going to bother me. I don't have to run in there and change her diaper and all this stuff. And I found myself kind of bereft of inspiration. But when I was in the same house with her and I could hear her on the monitor and I could hear her in there cooing or moving around, then it was almost as if the Holy Spirit was speaking through her and giving me these words, because I would go through a prayer and meditation every morning before I started writing to allow the words to come through me and not from me. And when I did that, you know, it's kind of like the muse would show up or spirit would show up and these words would start to fall out of me. But without that, I was kind of like hitting a wall, you know? So there's... It's a really strange thing to try to articulate and express, because it's a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, to a certain
degree. You might say strange again, and I say this on conversations with Roland, nothing is strange, especially if you look at the experiences that I've had, but I can totally understand what you're saying. And I did the same. I shouldn't say I did the same, but I had similar experiences when I was writing my book. I honestly, after my awakening, it happened, in late September 2018, I sat down the first weekend of September, and I just wrote everything down. And I was like, oh, I'm done. I'm going to publish this in December. It's going to be a bestseller. Everyone's life is going to be changed because I finally explained the Earth Life experience in a perspective and in a way that they can understand. No, it took me a whole year of writing afterwards. And what I learned was I would go through blocks like this where I just couldn't write. I remember one time I was on a plane trying to write my book and it was just crap that I wrote. I had to, you know, basically get rid of everything I'd written. Mm-hmm. But on another different way, I've seen this kind of experience play out where, right, you have this spiritual connection with somebody or something or an area or an environment that when you're in it, right, like you said, this muse shows up or this flow, you get into this flow and everything just works. And then when you're not in it, it doesn't work, is my cousin. He has two beautiful daughters who are young. They're under 5 years old. And so when he comes home from work and has to do homework, he can't. They're on his lap. They're telling him they want to play and all of that jazz. And he will call me and say, Roland, I wish my daughters could just go to your grandma's house for vacation or something like that for a week or two. And when they go, he can't do any work. Like, it's like his limbs are gone. He's like, where are my daughters? How are they doing? He's like worried about them. I think when they're gone, I'm going to work. When they're gone, I can't work. I'm just on the couch feeling like my life has no meaning. Like, where are my daughters? So that's another way that has shown up. And, you know, focusing again on Maria and on the idea of free will, choice, and judgment. Now, I want you to think about this from the perspective of someone who has gone through a life review already, right? There were times in the past where you got feedback to put Maria in an institution. And you and your wife never decided to do this. Okay. Right. Now, if you're looking back, if you had decided to do this, how would you have felt about that choice today?
About institutionalizing her today?
Yes. Yes.
If I had made that decision?
If you had made that decision. And I'm asking, just imagining that you made that decision and then you went through another near-death experience, like it would have been different, but you had a life review and you saw everything and you saw Maria still, right? The only difference would be I put her in an institution versus I didn't. It's kind of it's a very tough question, I know, but I'm just curious to.
Yeah. Well, I could tell you that this is the way I feel about it, whether it's right or wrong, but if I had institutionalized Maria, the book wouldn't have been written. I would never have evolved into the person that I've become. Maria's life has defined me. She's been my anchor. And it, as difficult as it's been through all this adversity, and I talk about this in depth in the chapter, The Gifts of Adversity, in the book. I talk about adversity being a gift. And adversity, I see adversity as a gift because it introduces us into this relationship with the Creator that we couldn't possibly have. You know, nobody learns anything or has some deep spiritual revelation when they're on vacation in Cancun, right? I mean, it's through the vicissitudes in life and adversity in life that we really become defined. And we find out who we are and what we're made of. And it's those choices, whether we give up or decide to persevere and move forward, that create either who we are now, or we get stuck in that kind of dark area of the web where we didn't fulfill our purpose and become everything that we were created to be. So my decision not to institutionalize Maria, first of all, you know, of course, at the time, I didn't know that I was going to die all of a sudden and have a massive heart attack and go into a 4-day coma and have an NDE and all these things. But my decision and Melanie's decision not to institutionalize her really came down to taking responsibility. We created her. And I believe that you create something, you have a responsibility to care for it, regardless of what happens. And that basic principle is kind of like what initially pushed us forward, because those early days, Roland, when she got sick, were just utterly horrifying. So we had to really work through some very, very difficult times in our marriage, with our own spiritual relationship with the Creator, and figure out, hey, think about what you're doing right now, because it's going to have essentially eternal implications. And we have to look at life sometimes that way, I think, because if we look at things from the end, it makes it easier to make the right decision sometimes, you know? So that decision to take responsibility for creating a human being and care for her and learn how to love, it defines me. That's why I dedicated the book to her. And think about this. This is the scariest thing that I can even think of. If it hadn't been for Maria, I would have gone through life just believing in the Creator and believing that I had a moral compass and doing the right thing. It's kind of like an insurance policy, really. But it was Maria that convinced me that God exists. And the rest is folly, really, because what else is there to know?
What else is there to know? Yeah.
Yeah. Once we understand that, we can have a much fuller life. And one of the things that the NDE did for me is remove fear and bring freedom into my life, because now I know where I'm going. There's really nothing to be afraid of. And I also know that there are implications and there are things that we have to take responsibility for in our life, you know, in order to evolve spiritually. and to learn these lessons that were here. So that's the long answer as to why we chose to keep Maria and all the good benefits that came from not institutionalizing her.
And I like it. I also like how you were able to, you know, add that this awakening kind of gave you a sense of freedom and eliminated a bunch of fear, maybe if not all, right? And, you know, many times we talk about, oh, I want to be free. I need freedom. Can you describe how that's different for you now after having gone through awakening?
Well, it's total freedom in the sense, look, nobody wants to die. I'm not looking forward to dying again, but I can tell you that I'm not afraid of it anymore either, because when I first came out of transplant and I was living in the apartment in Chicago by myself for that year, I could tell you that I went through at least the first 3-4 months. I went through this period of depression because I didn't want to be here. And it wasn't just the physical pain and the uncertainty of the future and would I ever be healthy enough to work again? None of that. It was because I wanted to be back into that place of love and light and unity where I was connected with everything and everyone. I wanted to be back in that place where I saw my daughter perfect and whole and where she spoke to me in that unspoken language of the ethereal. And so I was grappling with trying to figure out how to move forward, you know, because in this world, let's face it, it's tough. And we have to deal with things now, particularly now in this time and place that we're living in, that we didn't have to deal with maybe 10 years ago. It seems like it's getting tougher all the time, right? So trying to grapple with the beauty of the spiritual realm in that ethereal place, which the ethereal place to me was like an in-between place, and being back here in the world was difficult. And I would meditate every morning, you know, trying to get back into that place and couldn't do it. And I was really getting frustrated. And I had to accept the fact that I couldn't climb back up that ladder and that I had to learn how to see the divine in everything and everyone until I was complete. My spirit was completely free. And I do pass over to the other side for real. So yeah, that's the best way I can answer the question.
Yeah. And you know, in answering that question, you answered, or you touched on another question I was going to ask, which was how you've been able to assimilate into the earth life experience after having gone through such an experience. It's hard. It's like tasting the best love, this indescribable love and feeling and sense of perfection and everything. And then you come back here and it's like dense and slow and hard. And you can feel cold and feel too hot. You can get angry and people can make you mad. And you don't understand why, why you can't go back, right? You almost have that experience envy again. Why can't I just go back there? And I was going to ask how you've been able to assimilate it. And you touched on it a little bit. Mine has been, you know, always going back to remembering that the creator is everything and trying to, and trying to treat everything as this perfect, you know, being with the only judgment I'm passing is, holy crap, you are perfect regardless of how you show up. I'm not there yet. It happens to some people sometimes in certain situations, but it's not full all the time for me. And
it's
a real thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's, I haven't met anybody yet, by the way, that's just perfect. And, you know, they just are flowing through life and love to be here. And I mean, that's part of being human. Let's face it. We all struggle with these things.
Yeah.
But the way I assimilated, Roland, was that, again, I had this really neat moment with a Chinese pastor that came to see me while I was living in Chicago. And I broke down and because I didn't know the guy, so I felt safe. And I was on my front porch of my apartment one day and he came to visit and I kind of like broke down and cried and told him how I just didn't know where I belonged. And I felt so guilty for being here. And I felt guilty. There were a lot of other people on my floor, you know, younger people that had their whole lives ahead of them, older people with big families that didn't get a heart. They passed away. I felt guilty that I had all this support from family, employer, friends, and I didn't want to be here. And here I was. I know part of my mission was to come back and see Maria and my wife safely to the other side and to tell my story and all of these things. But yet I didn't know where I belonged. And this pastor, his name's Pastor Man. It was so funny because the Chinese have their own way of saying things. He looked at me and he said, "The solution to your problem is very simple." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, you have grown fat in the spirit from your journey." So he said, "To get thin again, give back to God in all the things that you do through kindness and faith and all of these things," he said, "and then you'll begin to see the divine in everything." And that really struck me. But he said to me, and then he ended it with, "You don't have to leave the earth to see the divine, because mm-hmm. it's all around you." Mm-hmm. And when he said that, you know, I went for a long walk and I began to take leaves from trees and open them up and examine them and see the incredible intelligent design in all things and all people. And I started to come back down to earth and find my anchor again. So that combined with understanding that we are these eternal spiritual beings helps me every day. And trust me, there are days that I don't want to be here. There are days that things get really tough, you know, personally, professionally with my daughter. And it's like, wow, I can't wait to get the heck out of here. But we know that we have to deal with it and that it builds character and it helps us again grow and helps define us. So these are the things that we deal with and manage every day. Yeah. But there's a freedom, you know, in all of this. I wouldn't change my experience for anything, having died, the heart transplant, Maria coming into the world as she did. It's been quite the journey.
Absolutely. And another part of your experience that I'm so glad, you know, you say you wouldn't change and you discuss in your book are, you know, the women in your life. You talk about your wife, you've talked about, you know, Maria, your daughter. We need to talk about the woman who is in your heart, right? The woman in your chest here. I should say this, if you're watching this video and you're listening to this podcast and you've not read the book, a bunch of spoilers, right? There are a bunch of spoilers here. But we have to talk about the woman in your chest. And it's really great how you, you know, learned that it was a woman and you connected with, you know, her father and her friends. Yes. But by the way, how is your heart doing? I got to ask. How is she doing? How's Molly doing?
Fantastic. Fantastic. But, okay. You know, so I do all the right things. I mean, I eat a very clean diet. I take care of myself. I exercise 4 times a week. Again, taking responsibility for yourself, right? Yeah. So I do all of these things and make sure that, because now I have, you know, two lives really living in here that I've got a responsibility to take care of both of them, because there is, when you have the essence of another being living inside you, there's a, let's put it this way, it's a whole nother dimension of living, which is very difficult to explain, because she does live inside me. I get promptings from her all the time. She wants to live on through me, express through me. I become more empathetic because of her. Molly was another one that took her own life, unfortunately. So when I first came out of coma and felt her inside me, at that time, I didn't know who it was, but I knew that there was a spiritual presence in me that wasn't mine. And that is the most fantastical thing, I have to tell you. And it's a real honor and privilege to carry her around with me and let her continue to live on and express. It's almost like we work in tandem. And she's also taught me how to give back more and pay forward more. I just had her best friend, who's the one that's in the book that really told me the most about Molly's life. I had her and her mother come down here recently, and they got to meet Maria. I took them to the beach. We spent three, four days together to get to know one another. And it was just an amazing experience. And it all confirms what I saw and became part of in that giant interactive web of twinkling lights, that we're all connected. We're all one. We all come from the same source. And it's to realize that this is the way that we're going to find peace within ourselves and peace within our world, when we realize that we're all one. And that is why we have to keep telling this story, spreading the message about this, because I could tell you, you know, I made assumptions about who was in me. I thought it was a male, you know, and it turns out to be a female. That's the craziest thing. And it's interesting because anatomically, men's hearts and women's hearts are the same, except women's hearts are typically smaller, which Molly's is smaller than my birth heart. But she's growing in there, and she's filling out that capacity in that pericardium sac that she lives in. And it's a, it's mind blowing when you think about this, right?
Of course. And, you know, at the beginning of this conversation, I told you, like, your spouse, I'm a pharmacist as well. And I distinctively remember in December of 2014, I was working on Christmas Eve, turned Christmas Day, because I was working overnight shift. And we had a patient in the ICU who was dying and who was an organ donor. And she was donating basically everything, her organs, plus even her skin. Skin is considered an organ too.
Oh, yeah.
And we were in the hospital, you know, coordinating, keeping her alive as long as we can, and coordinating with hospitals all across the United States to find a donor patient who could receive her organs. And it was on Christmas morning. I had worked all night from, you know, 9 p.m. the day before to 8 a.m. Christmas morning. But her surgery was planned for later that morning, and I stayed to watch it. And it was really fascinating the way it was all coordinated. Wow. Her heart and her kidney and I believe her lungs ended up in a patient in Ohio. So they had to charter a flight and a surgeon from Ohio to fly into Nashville in the morning, while the doctor and his surgical team was flying to come and harvest her organs from Ohio. We here in Nashville were taking care of her, and we brought her to the OR room. And while she's in the OR room, all prepped, right up until the minute where they, you know, she expired and they cut the heart, cut all the organs out, and we're ready to fly back to Ohio. They were in communication in real time with the doctors in Ohio and had to get the patient who was going to receive those organs into the OR and prepped, so that as soon as they flew and they landed, they would take an ambulance escort right to the hospital. Because as you're aware, the organs can only stay so long out of the body before they're transplanted. Right. It was a magnificent operation and experience. And for me to have witnessed all of this, I was in the OR room, I'm watching all of this, and it was very touching, because on Christmas Day of all days, this lady passes away. But look at this, like, amazing Christmas gifts that she gave to just about everybody else who received her organs, plus her skin. I didn't stay for the skin. I'm sorry if anyone's grossed out about what I'm saying here. But it was very touching. And, you know, in reading your story, I kept going back to that day and just seeing how amazing, right, being human is, and the gifts that we keep on giving even after we cease to animate this clay body that you keep, you know, you refer to. And what was also fascinating, you discussed this in your book, is how the personality of the the person whose organs you receive become part of your personality. And I think that that's touching. I'm saying all of this to really say, if you're listening, please read Rob's book. And then we need to end on this, because I have a feeling, you know, you're back here, you're reminding everybody that we're all one. And to me, that's unconditional love. If we're all one, we're all unconditional love.
Yes.
And one aspect about Molly's life, I really want you to touch on this, because it's a real thing, and it has to do with, you know, bullying and how people cope with bullying. And I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about this and just shedding some light on it. I think it's great. I think it's necessary, not great.
Sure, sure. You're referring to how social media was part of her demise and how she was bullied, and is that what you mean?
Yes, and how she coped with it. Yes.
Yes. So that, to me, honestly, before I wrote the book, I had never been on social media. I didn't have a Facebook page. I didn't know what a tweet was. I didn't know any of this stuff. And it was Natalie, Molly's best friend, when I was writing the book, who introduced me to this world of social media and how it works and the unreal reality of social media. A lot of these people aren't even real, and how the bullying and everything takes place, and everybody's striving for this perfect life. And that's the only thing they post online is, you know, their perfect life. They're going on the perfect vacation and marrying the perfect spouse and has the perfect diamond ring and the house and all of these things. And it was curious because Molly was just she was a beautiful, authentic person. And she got into this social media like all kids do her age and started posting things. And before long, you know, she started getting made fun of because she would do fun things with her friends, like dress up in these crazy outfits and go into Walmart at 11 o'clock at night on summer nights and run around. And so people started making fun of her, things like that. And as it went on and she got into this unreal reality world and started to focus on these things, she was drawn in and she found herself trying to conform and losing her own identity in this social media vortex. And it started to affect her self-esteem because she could never get herself up to these levels of perfection like these other girls were supposedly doing. But most of this stuff is fake. Nobody has this perfect life and this perfect body and this, all these things, right? So it began to affect Molly deeply. And so she gets even deeper in it, goes down this rabbit hole, tries to befriend people. Every time somebody wouldn't friend her on Facebook, she took it as a personal rejection. Then the bullying starts. And all of this led to a self-esteem problem. It led her to start thinking that she wasn't worthy, all of these things. And there were other things in Molly's life that drove her to committing suicide, unfortunately. But this played a big role, and it's a huge problem today. There are places now where families have to send their children to like detox from social media. They go to these camps like they would any other addiction. And when you think about that, it's just insane. And it's getting worse. It's getting worse now as these platforms continue to grow and everyone becomes involved because they feel that their own lives are either dull or boring or they don't have value. And again, they get caught up in this whole perfection game. They lose their own identity. And before you know it, they feel unworthy. And then one thing leads to another. When you feel unworthy about yourself, you might start drinking, you might start abusing your own body, you might start doing things that are unhealthy. And as we all know, those things lead you into the darkness. And we forget who we are. And then we are really vulnerable. So that's what I think you wanted me to speak to. Roland, right? That part of Molly's demise and how social media played a negative role in that.
Yeah. And I mean, it speaks to mental health as well. And, you know, we're hearing that a lot today in mainstream media and everything. And I have found by mistake, this was not my purpose, that, you know, an experience like meditating, mindfulness, any sort of meditation where you get to spend time knowing yourself is a very, very nice way to overcome any of these mental illnesses or to overcome the boredom that would propel you to spend most of your time in the full reality that is social media. And, you know, Sadhguru said this, and I'm paraphrasing, he says, hey, if you don't like spending time with yourself, then you are the problem in a way, right? It's like there's a problem with, you know, and I mean, we aren't taught that. We aren't taught to be able to sit comfortably and just observe ourselves. It's
right.
It's not something we're taught to do, and so we don't think it's normal. And so when we are in a position where there's nothing to do, we're bored, then we gravitate down these, you know, paths to find quote unquote excitement.
Right. And absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, you have to remember that, and I see this now. And I talk about this a little bit in the book. There's a section in the book where I talk about how the social media and these smartphones and the texting and all the things they do, these kids become zombie-like because they don't have or develop social skills. And, you know, when I used to travel, I'd go into restaurants and I would see families sitting at a table. The parents are on their phones. The kids are watching movies on their phones while texting one another across the table instead of talking. And it's kind of like we get this dumbing down and this numbing that takes place. And there's no human intercourse taking place, which this social intercourse that these kids need, you know, they have forgotten how to go outside and play and interact with nature and the environment. Nobody gets their knees dirty anymore or ride bicycles. I see it in my own neighborhood. When these kids reach a certain age and they get a phone, it's over.
It's over, yeah.
And it's really sad to me because, again, if you're bored, sometimes I think that means you're a boring person because, as you say, you're not spending enough time exploring your own mind and exploring your own personality because you have so much to give and offer. This all goes back to purpose. This is all tied together. Mm-hmm. It goes back to finding our purpose and to expressing what it is that we've come here to express. And these things take away the imagination. They take away our interaction with the world. It's a dangerous, dangerous path, I tell you.
Yeah. Oh, it most certainly can be. And
above
all, I guess it's a different way you can experience the creator too, right? Because through it, and not to take away from everything we just said there, but through it, you can find some very nice silver linings, people meeting people that they care about, lost family members, et cetera, starting, you know, nice social drives, even sharing information about like your book or this podcast. It kind of speaks to what Earth is, right? That choice. Like, what do you want to use what's available to you to help you experience, create, or express? And it takes knowing yourself through acts of like meditation to be able to take advantage of the tools that are available to you to continue to feedback into knowing yourself even better. Man,
you're right, Roland. I mean, like you say. Look, if it weren't for podcasts like this, which obviously go out through social media, you know, no one would get to hear the story. Mm-hmm. So it does have its place, just like anything else that can be used for good or abused. So absolutely, I want to make sure I'm not saying that all social media is bad. It's the misuse of social media, like anything else, that becomes toxic. So
absolutely. No, yeah. And we get it. Anyone listening to this podcast should get it, hopefully, but the fact that you're clarifying is even better.
Man, I'm sure they do.
See, I usually try to keep the conversations at an hour. Rob, you're just so fascinating. We're over an hour and a half here and we could still go. I mean, there's one thing that I really enjoyed at the beginning of your book, and this might seem very trivial, but it is my experience today. coupled with my meditation experiences, and it has to do with our sleeping postures. And you talked about this as a kid, how you slept, right? And it's something I kind of noticed over time, and I'm excited that you mentioned it in your book, where I noticed that if I were dealing with a lot of emotional things, if I wasn't free, I slept, my sleeping posture was one of more protection. I would close up and kind of pull my knees to my chest and all that jazz. And my daughter, who was just born, she's got no cares, no worry in the world. She sleeps like a star. Her hands are up, you know, kind of above her head, and her legs are spread open. She just looks like a star. And I noticed that if I had a nice meditation session and I was feeling really good, I kind of slept loose like that, you know, sort of free. And have you used that to change the way you are sleeping today? Is that something you're incorporating in your night routine?
I try to do that because, and I'm glad you brought it up. And by the way, Roland, so lots of spoilers here.
I know. I read the book.
That's okay, man. Yeah. I'm glad you read the book.
Yeah.
But yes, because your daughter's a perfect example, which is how I used to be. And by the way, all children, you know, when you see them sleep, right, they're open to the world. Their limbs are just thrown out everywhere. Their palms are to the sky. They're open to the world. It's almost like they're receiving all this wonderful information, and they're just open to it all, which lends itself to what I'm saying about, you know, we're born innately good. We come into this world pure. We're open to receiving all of these things. But when my father died, that's when I decided to start sleeping on my belly. When I was a child, my hands curled tightly under my chest and kind of, as you mentioned, you know, in a protective state and afraid to open myself back up and in fear of losing something or being harmed. So yes, now, and sometimes it's difficult, that I will always try to remain on my back with my hands open on my sides when I sleep. And it's kind of like, you know, inviting the universe to come in, and I feel so much more relaxed that way and opened up, because body language, I mean, books have been written, the science of body language, which is incredibly fascinating to me. You know, it says so much about us, because this is the vessel that we're in, and this vessel, it's going to react to its environment and to what's going on in our minds spiritually. So glad you brought it up. Yeah, because it's a fascinating thing.
It is. Humbly, Rob, I have to say thank you so much for, you know, sharing your experience. Many people go through such life transformative experiences and just keep it within your social circles. You're out. You've had multiple podcast conversations recorded and shared. I'm so humbled that you and your team were very, very adamant about coming on conversations with Roland. I'm glad that you did.
Thank you.
Keep sharing, keep spreading this new message of we are one, right? We are all this quarks of light, like you say. And I invite everybody listening, please get a copy of his book. It's on Amazon. It's a number one bestseller. And you can connect with Rob through his website, Rob A. Gentile. That's GENTILE.com. And I'll have links to your website in the notes section of this podcast. And I'm excited for what else is coming, you know, from the Rob Gentile camp. I think it's something that we can all definitely use in the world today as a beautiful reminder of who we are and why we are. I think so.
Thank you, Roland. Thank you so much for that. It's been a marvelous experience, and I really appreciate our conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Likewise. All right, guys. You know how to connect with me, Roland at chenjiang.com. If you're liking these conversations, please, I invite you to share it with friends and family. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. This is the first time I'm really asking that you do this while listening to a conversation with Roland video podcast. And above all, I invite you, as always, to create an amazing day. Thank you. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you so much. Talk soon.
Indeed.